name's Todd, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 2nd of 1996. The Midtown Group in Washington, D.C. is my home group. And I'm eternally grateful for all those things. I have a sponsor. His name is Josh. Probably the most important things that I will say to you tonight are those three things. I have a home group, a sponsor, and a sobriety date. Because those are the foundation of this new way of life that I'm trying to live today. And none of those three things were present in any prior attempt I ever made to get sober. Like I said, I am an alcoholic. I grew up probably like most people. I did not aspire to be an alcoholic. You know, I didn't go to my high school guidance counselor, or, you know, it wasn't one of my goals in life to wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous or to become a drunk and literally tear the hearts out of anybody that ever loved or cared for me. But that's what happened. Because I'm an alcoholic, something happens to me when I take a drink of alcohol that doesn't happen to most people. And I didn't know that. You know, I was 12 years old when I had my first drink. I was standing around the campfire outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, which is where I'm from. A bunch of older kids, and that's a lot of what we did growing up was drink around campfires. And somebody passed a bottle of Jack Daniels my way, and I took a drink. And there was no forethought about it. There was no, you know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. It's what everyone else was doing, and it's what I did. And what happened to me apparently didn't happen to the other people there that night. Because they're all people that I grew up with. They're all people that I've known, you know, my whole life. And none of them are in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I am. And that's because of that weird reaction that I had. And what happened to me when I took that drink of alcohol, and what happens to me every time I take a drink of alcohol, is I want more. And I become willing to pay any price necessary to get more. And it doesn't matter who you are or what it is, I'm willing to let that go once I have that first drink of alcohol to get more. And I'm the type of alcoholic that I don't know that I ever had a social drink. I don't know that I ever drank anything more than I drank until I passed out, ran out, or somebody stopped me. And that's from the first drink on. And you know, I didn't run right out at 12 years old and the next day and do it all over again. But I had a good time. I had a good time. I wasn't nervous. I wasn't afraid. You know, it was just a normal night with the guys. And I enjoyed it. And the next time alcohol became available to me, I drank it. And over time, what happened to me is probably what happened to most of you guys. All the outside stuff, all the people, all the things that we used to do started to go away. And more it started to become me drinking by myself. And I was in high school, and I was blessed with a little bit of athletic ability. And that kept me out of a lot of trouble, to be honest with you. I played football, basketball, and ran track in high school, and I was pretty good at all three of them. And teachers and coaches and all kinds of people helped me get through high school. You know, because all throughout high school I thought I was above the law. I drank every time I could. Two nights before the state championship football game my junior year of high school, the coach caught me and one other player buying beer. You know, that's the kind of person I was. I loved playing balls. Still to this day, it's my most favorite thing in the world. Loved it. But it came second to alcohol for sure. And I had a chance to run in the state track meet my senior year. I was one of the favorites to win. The night before, I was at a place called the Boston Beanery. I drank till 3 a.m. Too hungover and sick the next morning to perform well. And that's the kind of stuff that I did when drinking. And that was in high school. That was early on when things were supposed to be good. You know, I started getting picked up in Blacksburg in high school. You know, petty things, drunk in public. Little things like that, you know, urinating off a bridge was one charge. I just was going around and I thought I was having a good time. The police knew me. Blacksburg's a small enough town, they know you. I didn't need to see a driver's license or an identification, and I'd go to Montgomery County Jail, which is the next town over, spend the night in the drunk tank, because I only called Mom once. I was 15 years old, and one of my friends passed out, and we thought it'd be a good idea to shave his head bald. And so we broke into a hair salon, and we shaved his hair bald, and then we sat around in the hair salon and drank to our victory while he was just laying passed out. And, of course, somebody saw people in the hair salon, they called the police. The police picked us up. We went down, and they called my parents. My dad came to pick me up. He didn't speak to me the whole way home. He didn't even look at me. I got home. My mother was in tears. You know, what kind of son have I raised? And that wasn't my first experience with drinking with them or coming home drunk or anything like that, but it was the first that involved the police, and they were embarrassed. And so I learned a lesson. Don't call mom and dad when you get in trouble. And I would get picked up for drunk in public, or we'd get picked up for something, and I'd just spend the night in jail. I'd get out the next morning, I'd call a friend to pick me up or catch a bus and go back where I needed to go and just tell my parents I spent the night with somebody. And it was easy. They didn't really, neither one of my parents are alcoholics. They're not even close. My mother's never been drunk a day in her life. My grandfather, my mom's dad, he died of alcoholism. He was drunk. He fell down a flight of steps. He broke his neck. And he was an alcoholic. He drank, you know, every day. He had problems with drinking. He would tell you he had a problem with drinking, but he had no desire to quit or do anything different. And my mom saw that when she was a teenager. So my mother never touched alcohol. You know, she's had two drinks in one sitting once in her life. Made her feel a little funny, and she's never done it again. And my dad, he's just a normal person. He'd have a beer every now and then, but it never meant anything to him. He didn't enjoy getting drunk. So they didn't really understand me. And my parents' solution to what the way I was behaving was, my dad made a deal with me. He would buy the alcohol if I wouldn't leave the house. And so the friends would come over, and, you know, he'd buy a little bit and they'd bring a lot and we'd have enough. And growing up in Blacksburg, I never had a curfew. My parents, if I got in trouble at my friend's house, they could discipline me. My parents would support that, and vice versa. So it was a little network, and I never had to tell them where I was going or what I was doing. They just, you know, they trusted me in that way. And if you're an alcoholic like me, that's a great thing. And I had a friend move away when I was a sophomore that my parents didn't know too well, didn't really know his family. And I didn't tell my parents until I was a senior he had moved away, but I spent the night at his house apparently a lot of nights. And you know, that's the other thing about me as an alcoholic. I've been a liar from the get-go. You know, I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I want what I want when I want it, and I'm willing to lie for it, I'm willing to cheat for it, I'm willing to steal for it, it doesn't matter. You know, because I'm sure that this thing that I'm about to get is going to be the thing. This is the one that's going to make me feel the way I'm going to feel. I need to feel the way that I'm supposed to feel. And that's the way I treated alcohol, and that's the way I treated anything in my life. I got an opportunity to run track in college, and I went off to run track at this little college in Bridgewater. I was there for 1 year. I won a conference championship in my event. It's the longest stint since I was 14 that I had sober. I went that entire track season that without drinking and alcohol. Because I was positive, if I could prove, because no other freshman in the history of this conference, 50-year-old conference, had ever done this. I was sure, if I could do this, that would make me feel the way I wanted to feel. And so I didn't drink. And I got up at 6 o'clock every morning, and I ran, and I worked out, and I did the things you have to do if you want to be good in something like that. And I accomplished my goal. And it didn't do for me what I needed done. But I knew what did. And I sat in the shower after that with a bottle of Jack Daniels and cried and got drunk beyond belief. And that was the last considerable period of sobriety I would have before I met Alcoholics Anonymous. I had one other stint for 3 weeks later on because I met her. And she was going to do it. But she showed up 30 minutes late one night, and by that time I was already off to the liquor store. But that was it. And I got thrown out of that school shortly thereafter. I got in a fight in the mailroom with a guy. I was never very violent drunk, but I was always violent sober. And I didn't understand that for a long time. And I'd hear guys come into AA and say they'd have a bunch of beers and beat somebody up. And that happened from time to time. But usually when I was drinking, I wasn't interested in fighting. Wasn't interested in girls, wasn't interested in anything. I was interested in drinking. But sober, I would become really uncomfortable. And I would become paranoid, and I would think that people didn't like me, and I'd have these conspiracy theories about how I wasn't getting treated the way I was supposed to get treated, and I would get in these fights. I would explode. I would lose my temper. And a girl that I had broken up with started dating a new guy, and he was a member of the football team and a fairly big fellow, and he made a comment to me, and that hurt my ego. That hurt my pride. And I felt like I had to do something. So you know, being what I was, I started a fight in the mailroom, and I beat that guy into the hospital. But in that process, a teacher, a little psychology teacher, he couldn't have been any bigger than Victor, a little small guy, tried to break up the fight. And I pinned him up against the lockers. I put my forearm in my throat, and I told him I was going to kill him if he didn't leave me alone. And as you can imagine, the school frowns on that kind of behavior. And they politely asked me not to come back. So I went back home to Mom and Dad. And that's another theme for me. When all else fails, you know, you go home to Mom. And I was to stay there, and I worked for the athletic department at Virginia Tech for a little while, taking care of the football field, the baseball fields, and loved the job. We'd be there in the morning, we'd drink at lunch, get off at 3, go drinking, and I was in heaven. That was the job for me. But I also wanted to get out of Blacksburg. So I was getting back in trouble again. I was starting to spend the overnights in Montgomery County again, and it just wasn't the right deal for me. And I got an opportunity to come up to George Mason, and that's what led me up in this area. And I left the same way I left to do anything in my life. I left with the belief that this time it was going to be different. This place, I'm going to make it happen. And what happened at this point in my drinking was that I drank alone more than I drank with people. So I rented a one-bedroom apartment. My parents were paying for the apartment. I got a little job. I got several little jobs over the time period. And I was going to George Mason, and this is how I was living. I was drinking almost around the clock, as much as my body could handle. I can't say I drank every day, because sometimes I drink myself so sick I had to take a day off. But I would drink before I went to class, because I needed it, because I just felt I was here 15 minutes, and it was just too many people here. You know, this isn't the place for me. I hadn't even been here in school more than a day or two when I decided that this was not the place for me. There were too many people. They weren't the right kind of people. And in order to go to class, I would have to drink. And I always thought I was pretty slick. And I would put Jack Daniels in Coke bottles. And I knew you could smell that. I'm not dumb. So what I thought was a good solution is mint leaves. Mint leaves smell really strong. And if you notice on the bottom of a 20-ounce Coke can, they have the little plastic. I would take the plastic off, punch holes in it, and put a mint leaf in it, put the plastic back over and go to class, and take off the top and set the top down on the desk in class. And I would think, in my sick, twisted head, I thought, you could smell the mint, not the liquor. And I would sit in class, and I would drink, and I was able to get, you know, I was able to do well. I was able to show up on a fairly regular basis most of my drinking. And I didn't show up out of virtue. I showed up out of fear. Because as long as I was showing up, I could convince myself that I didn't have a problem, that I was okay. You know, it talks about in the big book that we think our life is the only normal life. And that was part of the delusion for me that I was living a normal life. Yeah, sure, I had problems. Yeah, I like to drink a lot. Who doesn't? You know, but I'm still showing up. I'm graduating college. I'm able to do these things. You know, and something happened at this point, and I started to become a blackout drinker. And I may have been a blackout drinker before, but it wasn't as noticeable because I was always around people that I was pretty comfortable with. But now I would go out. I was living in a trailer. At this point, really near the school, right across the street from a bar. I was, you know, 10 a.m. when they opened, the bartender knew me by name, you know, and that's what I would do. I would go there in the mornings, but I had developed a problem. I couldn't always control my bladder. Sometimes I'd wet my pants, and I started to have these blackouts. And I didn't really know much about a blackout. You know, I never ran around with people or was associated with people that, A, talked about what they thought or felt in any real sort of way. It was all bravado, you know. I'm going to beat you up, or I'm better than you, or any of that kind of stuff. I never really hung out with anybody that would say they were afraid. I was over a year and a half sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when somebody explained to me that anger that I feel sober is actually fear. I never knew that. You know, I never knew I was afraid. I could not have labeled that emotion fear. Because I had never been around anybody that had ever talked like that. You know, and what I had seen is that all these other people never looked afraid. I had seen them get in fights. I had seen them do these things. And so I believed that that feeling inside of me was just a part of that. You know, and I didn't know that was fear. I didn't know that anger was fear. And I really was so delusional, I didn't know I was afraid. I'd have told you if you'd asked me my first couple weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have told you I'm not afraid of anything. And that just wasn't so. The truth was I was petrified of everything. And I grew up in this household. My mom goes to church every day. It's what she does. She's a real woman of faith. In my sobriety, I've really grown to cherish and appreciate this woman and her beliefs. And my dad's a deacon in the church. They're both very active, and they're there every Sunday, and I was there every Sunday of my life, drunk, sober, hungover, it didn't matter. And they definitely gave me the opportunity to have a relationship with God, but I didn't want it. You know, if you're selfish and self-centered like me, there can't be a God, because I need the answer yesterday. I want what I want now, and God doesn't seem to work that way. The answers come, but I don't always like the answers. And somewhere along the line, I wanted something I didn't get, and I was done. You know, and I would go to church as a child and see all these people and my mom and everybody come back so happy, and I just didn't get it. I just didn't get it. I was so selfish and self-centered, I just didn't get it. Because it was always about me. And if I couldn't directly relate to what that preacher was saying or minister was saying, it just didn't seem to make any difference in my life. You know, if somebody had stood up here and said, you know, if you do this, you'll get what you want, I'd have been the most faithful person you ever met. You know, like our big book says, I'd been faithful, abjectly faithful to the God of reason. You know, and abjectly is mistakenly. You know, I had mistakenly thought that I was going to think my way into whatever it was that I wanted. And that's how I lived. And you don't need a God if you think you can think your way through it. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found out another key fact about me. I don't act on what I think. Not as often as I would have believed. I act on how I feel. And what happens to me is I react to my feelings, good, bad, or indifferent. And then my thinking helps me justify the behavior I just took. And I didn't know that. I always thought I acted off my thinking. If I could somehow think something different, I wouldn't behave this way. I didn't know what was driving the ship, and it's these emotions that I have no control over. And the reason I have no control over them is because I'm so selfish and self-centered. I'm so in my own little place, and it's about me and how I feel and what I want, that I just have never been able to connect that perhaps there's something outside of me. And I didn't know any of that, and I'm drinking, and I'm in this town, and I don't have any friends. You know, I was in Fairfax for several years. I think about two and a half years, and I made no friends. I just lived in this one-bedroom apartment. The only people that I really hung out with was the guy next door, was in the military in the honor guard, and he and I would drink together sometimes, or I would help him, get away from his wife and his baby when he wanted to drink the way he wanted to drink. And that was really it. I didn't have anybody else, and I wasn't really interested in it at this point. I was interested in drinking. And like I said, I would have these blackouts. And the first one I had, I was supposed to be studying for a test, and you know, it was a fairly big deal. And the test was on a Tuesday. It was a Tuesday-Thursday class. And I started drinking on Monday to prepare for the test. And I woke up, and I went to the class, and everyone else was in the classroom, but they were very calm. And I was kind of frantic, pre-test frantic, you know. And the professor walked in, and the professor, you know, talked for a couple minutes and then said that he would have the exams passed back at the end of class. And what had happened was Tuesday and Wednesday went by, and I don't know what happened. And then I started having experiences. I was living in Fairfax, Virginia at that time, and I woke up one morning, and I was naked in a hotel room by myself, which is a little unusual. And I went to the window, and I looked outside that window, and I didn't recognize any of the scenery. And so I got myself together. It was a Holiday Inn, and they have the little coffee and donut bagel things for free, and I thought some coffee would do me some good. And I went down, and as I was going down, I looked at the wall, and there were a lot of maps of Ohio, and I thought that was pretty odd. And I went down there, and I got myself a cup of coffee, and I took it about as long as I could take it, and then I just had to know. And I walked up to this poor lady at the reception desk, and I asked her, I said, "Excuse me, ma'am, can you tell me where I am?" And she rattled off a couple streets. And I'll never forget this lady's face as long as I live. I looked her dead in the eye, and I said, "No, ma'am, what city am I in?" And her eyes got real big, and she kind of cocked her head to the side because she didn't know what to make of me. And she said, "You're in Cincinnati, Ohio." And to this day, I have no idea why I went to Cincinnati, Ohio. I know no one in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I don't know how many days have passed. I just woke up there. And that stuff started happening to me. And like I said, I was having bladder trouble, so I would, you know, have those debates in my head about what I should do. And I'd walk down the adult diaper option aisle, and I'd think about it. And no, I can't do that. And you know, I came up with this is how I think, this is how I am. I came up with a different solution, and the solution I came up with is I went out to a hardware store and I bought a bucket about this big and about this big. This wide, it was a green bucket, and I set it next to the chair that I drink in, and then I took off all my clothes, and I figured I'd just aim. And I actually thought this was a good solution to my problem. I mean, I was almost to the point where I wanted to tell somebody about this solution. Now, it never dawned on me that maybe drinking was the problem. You know, I had solved the problem now, no problem, just drink naked and hope, you know? And that's where I was. And I got an opportunity at this point to move somewhere else to go to a program at Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia. And I took it. And I moved again with the same mentality that I had moved to Northern Virginia. This is a smaller town. It's more like Blacksburg. It's more like where I grew up. This time it's going to be different, man. I'm going to get the whole thing together. I'm going to get back on track. You know, if there's anything that that I can say for this alcoholic, it's that I always believe the next time is going to be the right time. But I was too far gone at that point. And it didn't really matter where you stuck me. You know, I was living to drink. And all the other things didn't really matter. And I got sicker when I went to Huntington, and I didn't think that was possible. But I got to Huntington, and I started to become so paranoid I quit driving, because cars would be following me, and the car would turn off miles ago, but I would, you know, they're back there, and it just became too much for me, so I quit driving. I had a job at that time. Believe it or not, my job was at the graduate school, helping freshmen adjust to college life. Now, only an alcoholic can pull that off. But I worked in the dean's office. I had my own office. At this time, I carried a flask. I didn't go more than an hour or two without a drink if I had to be around anybody, for sure. And so I would drink and talk to these freshmen about not drinking and studying, and that was my job. And one particular day, the electricity and the power went out. And when it came back on, in the 5 minutes or so that power was out, I had completely convinced myself that they were all out to get me. And when the power came back on, the phone started to ring in my office, and I could hear them outside. I don't know if this is true, but from my perception, they were all talking about me and why I wasn't answering the phone. And the truth was, I just didn't have the power to answer the phone. It was too much for me. I was so in my head. And I was so paranoid, and I was so out of it, I couldn't do it. So I got up from my chair, I walked past every one of them, I didn't say a word, I went out the door, and I've never been back. I went back when I was 9 months sober to make amends to that dean. And I thought that dean didn't know, but he knew. It's amazing, when I went back to make my amends, how much people knew about me that I didn't think they knew. And this guy knew. And they actually, the only reason they hadn't fired me is because they were hoping beyond hope that me having that commitment would help me get pull out of whatever it was that was wrong with me. But I left that day and I didn't go back. And I had developed this habit. I don't know if you guys are like me, but when I drink alcohol and I run out of alcohol and I'm not done drinking, I've got a problem. And that would happen to me from time to time in the beginning, and I wasn't able to go out. It's past 2 a.m. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's just me. It's my head. It's my feelings. And I'm crazy. Well, I don't know what you guys do, but I would call my mom at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I would tell her I'm going to commit suicide. Now, I've been suicidal in my life, honestly suicidal in my life twice. Once was a very bad thing happened to me in high school. My brother is very sick. It's not with alcoholism. He's got some mental problems. And I didn't stand up for him. And I let some kids beat him up. And I felt horrible about that. And I stuck a pistol in my mouth with a chamber in it, spun it, and clicked it once. And when it clicked and it didn't go off, I figured I wasn't meant to die. And I wasn't suicidal again until what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I would lie about suicide if it would help me. I didn't have a problem with that. And I would call my mom and tell her I wanted to kill myself. I'd tell her how bad my life was. Maybe you guys had somebody like that and you're drinking, that sounding board, that person that just had to absorb all your sickness. Well, that was my mother. Because of the woman she was and the faith she had, she could not pick up the phone. And I was several years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I realized that when I hung up the phone with my mother, she couldn't go back to sleep. And I can't even imagine what she must have felt, you know, after those phone calls. But I do know this. I would talk to her until I felt better. And then I would hang up on her. I wouldn't say goodbye. I'd hang up on her because I was ready to go to bed now. And then to make sure she didn't call me back and bother me, I'd pull the jack out of the phone so she couldn't call me back so the phone wouldn't ring so I could sleep. And I started waking up in the morning with the shakes. And I started waking up in the morning with the dry heaves. And I became that guy that stood outside the liquor store at 8:45 in the morning, pacing, waiting for it to open. I became that guy. And in the beginning, I would be the guy that would go in and walk around like I didn't know what I wanted. You know, and make it a lie up. Like, you know, I'm sure glad you guys open at 9 a.m. Got to go to work, having a party later. Just would have been too much to get it in the afternoon. You know, or, yeah, I've got some friends in, I'm just, you know. But, you know, after 3 or 4 days of that, you know, they know. But in my head, I thought I was fooling somebody. And the reality was I was trying to fool myself. I really didn't want to take a look at the way I was living. And I became what most of us become, the ultimate victim. And if you sat me down at that point in my life, I could name 500 people that were to blame, but not one of them was me. And I could tell you 500 reasons why I do the way I do and behave the way I behave, but not one of them would be related to my selfishness, my self-centeredness, or my immaturity. You know, and it was all about somebody else. It was all about, you know, if I could just get this set of circumstances right, I am going to be able to beat this thing. But I was sick. I started, my parents eventually asked me to stop calling. That's what happened. My meal ticket with my mother ran out. My dad picked up the phone one of those nights, and I knew that was trouble. And he said, "We love you, but you can't do this anymore." You know? And so I had to have another solution. The solution I came up with is vanilla and lemon extract. And when that would happen to me, I would go to a 24-hour place, and I would buy vanilla or lemon extract, and I would drink that. And I would have this crisis of conscience or whatever it was, and I would say, you know, I'm done. Look, everybody's leaving you. You're like, you can't even work anymore. You know, I'm done. And I would say I'm quitting. And something would happen to me from 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and 8:30, 8:45 in the morning where my whole perception of the thing would change. And I'd been overreacting. Or I would just think, you know what, it's a Tuesday. Who the hell quits drinking on a Tuesday? You know, I'm going to quit on Sunday like most people do, you know, and then justify it for a few more days. Or I would get up and I would make it a little while and the pressure would come back and the fear would come back and the intensity of life would come back and I couldn't deal and I would be angry and I wouldn't know what to do with it and I would just say the hell with it. You know, I'm just not able to do it. You know, and I started to have the phenomenon that I believe only alcoholics can have. When I would make the decision to drink after being sober for any period of time, I would instantly feel better because I knew it was coming. I I knew I was going to be okay. And I would be walking to the liquor store or to the grocery store to buy the beer, and I would be able to breathe again. And if, you know, if you'd have introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous back then, I don't think I could have had it. Because no one had mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous to me. No one had mentioned an alcoholic in my life. My mother had mentioned it a few times about my grandfather. You know, but I would not have told you it was the drinking, even though I just described to you how I was living. Because when I'm sober, it's the problem. And so I couldn't be alcoholic. You know, alcohol helps. I need it. You know, sobriety, I'm all screwed up. I'm out in left field. I don't know what to do. You know, so if you'd have said I'm an alcoholic, I'd have said, no, I'm not. Because I'm fine when I drink. It's when I'm sober. Because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. And I started to run out of money. And I became the guy that would steal your wallet and help you look for it. You know, and I stole things before they were officially lost. And I started doing the things I needed to do to get enough money together to do what I needed. And I had two of those girls, 18-year-old girls that had been in my program when I could work. I ran into them, and they needed to buy alcohol. And I picked up on the game, and this is the type of person I am. I convinced these girls to go once a week and sell their blood to get money for the three of us to drink. Now, I wasn't going to do that myself. You know, I'm not going to go sell my blood. But, you know, you want me to buy alcohol for you, go sell your blood, get us some money. And these women did that until they realized that they're women and that tons of guys on this planet will buy them alcohol without forcing them to go sell their blood. And that meal ticket left. And that was really the last ticket that I had. Was these two girls, and they, you know, they did it for a little while, and I was able to get what I needed, and I was behind. I was about to be evicted in the place I lived, about to be homeless, and I had trouble scraping up enough money every day, you know, to get the liquor that I needed, and I was crazy, and I was tired, and I didn't know what to do, and suicide came back for the second time, what I did is I bought a bottle of sleeping pills and took 32 sleeping pills while I drank my Jack Daniels, one in every shot, and just kept going. And then I sat, and like a good alcoholic, I started thinking, and I decided somebody should know the tragedy that is about to occur. And I don't know who you call, but I called probably the only person I could have called. I called an ex-girlfriend. And I called her up on the phone, and I proceeded to tell her my tale of woe, and she hung up on me. And luckily for me, she called the police. And the police and ambulance and the landlord got into my apartment and found me unresponsive on the ground, rushed me to the emergency room, put a tube down. I don't remember any of this. I just know from what my parents say in the record, and pumped my stomach. And I woke up the next morning to my mother, my father, and a strange dude in a suit. And I intuitively knew the strange dude in the suit was a problem. And what they told me was that I was very sick, and that I had a choice. I could go spend some time in jail, or I could go to a rehab, but I was too sick to walk out of that place. And I'm not an idiot, you know. I picked the rehab. And I went into that rehab on May 1st of 1996, and I haven't had a drink since then. And the first 4 days that I was in rehab, I was in hospital with the DTs at 23 years old. I had a fever of 102 to 103. I shook constantly. I couldn't keep down food. They had to stick me something like 30 or 40 times to get an IV into my veins. And I was crazy. I don't remember much about it, and I'm thankful for that. But I do remember the first thing that I ate after that was a popsicle. And I remembered how good it tasted. And that rehab, I don't remember a thing they told me. But they did the best thing in the world they could have done. They took people from that rehab to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't really get it. I didn't get it. Because I still had this perception that an alcoholic is a person that once they quit drinking, their life just takes off. You know, and that's not my experience. My experience is just the opposite. Once I quit drinking, all hell breaks loose. And I don't know what's going to happen. And I would listen to these people, and I just couldn't hear them. And I got out of the rehab, and I went home to my parents' house. They decided to let me back in since I was trying to do something different. And I was sitting on the couch, and my mother said to me, "Would you like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And so I'm sober today and alive today because my mother drove me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and dropped me off at the front door. Because I don't think I would have had the power to do that myself. You know, and I went into that meeting, and it was a great meeting. It was in Blacksburg, Virginia. It was a great meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There were 8 people there. They somehow knew I was the new guy. And I started to get indoctrinated into Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't even know it. You know, and because they said things to me. You know, and they said in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, we get this thing called a sponsor. Well, the only thing I really knew about sponsorship was if somebody sponsored you, they gave you money. That was my perception of sponsorship. So that seemed like not such a bad deal. You know, and a guy said to me, "Why don't you go ask that guy?" And I walked up to that guy, and I asked him to be my sponsor. Now, I had no idea what I was asking or getting myself into or any of that. But I wanted these people to like me. You know, I've always wanted people to like me. You know, and I've always been willing to play a certain amount of your game for you to like me. And that's what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. The same tools that I had as a child that protected me. The ability to fit in, to blend in, to be a chameleon. The things I used in my alcoholism to survive saved my life when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's a twist. It only works for a little while in Alcoholics Anonymous, and those very same traits kill you and take you back to drinking. But when you're new, they'll save you. And that one saved me. The wanting to be liked by these people that I did not understand saved my life. Because I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he said I needed to call him, and I didn't want to let him down, so I would call him. And they said to me at the meeting, after the meeting, we go to the coffee shop, and we hang out, and we get coffee. And I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for months before I realized that was a choice, not a requirement. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous became meeting coffee. I thought it was, you know, kind of the same deal. And these people were the first people in a long time that would hang out with me. They wanted to have anything to do with me. You know, they didn't judge me for the stories I told you and the weird things that would go on and the fact that sometimes I came into Alcoholics Anonymous yelling. Not because I was necessarily so angry. I was so raw, sober, I could not speak to you in this tone of voice. I could yell or I could say nothing. And that's what they had to deal with when I was new. And my friend, I have a friend that was there from the beginning, who lives in California now, and he said they would know that I was coming from a block away because they could just hear me talking. And I was loud in everything I did because my body did not enjoy being sober. And I started getting involved in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started getting, you know, involved in the fellowship, and I was going every night, and I had a car, and this guy didn't have a car, and I became his personal chauffeur, and that probably saved my life. And I would literally pick this guy up every day. And we would go to a meeting. And then we would go to coffee. And then I would go home. And I wasn't able to be employed at that time. I just was too sick. But my parents were willing to let me do that. And in Blacksburg, there's not 2 meetings a day or 3 meetings a day or some of the things that you enjoy in the Washington, D.C. area. There's a meeting every day. And I was there. And during the day, I would do tasks for my mom or whatever needed to be done because my sponsor had told me, just don't sit at the house. And a lot of the guys that were sober were students at Virginia Tech, and I would hang out with them during the day in between their classes. And I started to get a social life, and I started to become connected to these people. And then a strange thing happened, and most of those people drank. And they drank the same night at the same party, and I was there. And a bunch of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, all young, nobody with over a year, decided that they were going to have a party, and one of them decided to bring booze. And we were in the room, and I watched all these people in Alcoholics Anonymous drink. I was 6 months sober, and I was terrified. I did not know whether I was going to drink or not. I had no idea. I was just debating it in my head. So I'm watching these people that had been my friends that I'd been hanging out with all drink. And all the young people in AA in Blacksburg were there, save one. And that was my friend Bill that now lives in California, the guy that I picked up every night for the meeting. And I freaked out and I called him. And I went over to his house. And the two of us stayed sober. And some of those people from back then I've heard over the years are in jail. I know at least one of them's dead. But I don't know of any of them that have come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's been 11 years. And I wish I could say that that, you know, planted me firmly in Alcoholics Anonymous. But if there's anything I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's that what happened yesterday will not keep me sober today. And that experience is a great experience for me, and it taught me a lesson about hanging out in sober places with sober people who are interested in sober things and how important that is. But I can't stay sober on that event, you know. I ended up getting an opportunity to come back to George Mason for a second time to finish the master's degree that I had been up here the first time for. And I came back, and I was 7 months sober. And I wish I could tell you that I jumped right into AA and everything, but at 7 months sober, I felt good. I'd just been through that six-month deal. I knew I was okay in this sobriety thing. And so I went to one meeting a week, whether I needed it or not. I had a service position at that meeting, because I was told that you should always have a service position in Alcoholics Anonymous, something you're committed to. So I was the coffee maker for this one meeting a week. And I would go to this meeting, and I became sicker sober than I might have been drunk in a very short period of time. What happened is I had a job at the school as part of my graduate assistantship. I was working for the foundation, the George Mason Foundation. And they have a huge file room, probably about as big as this stage, and they had a table in the middle of it. And my job was to keep that file room straight and to get files and things to people that needed it. And what I would do is I'd go in every morning, I'd lock the door behind me, I'd sleep on the table. Then I would go to lunch, then I would come back, and if somebody saw me or I thought somebody was going to see me, I'd duck in the bathroom. And I avoided you at all costs. I became so frightened that I would order a pizza and I couldn't open the door to the pizza delivery guy. I'd slide the money through, I'd have him set the pizza down, and when he was long gone, I'd open the door and get the food. You know, I couldn't go out to the gym or do anything like that because I was too petrified of people. So I started running around the couch in my living room for exercise. And this was the way that I was living sober. Now, I'm not drinking, and this is how I'm living. And I'm slowly dying. And I don't even know it because I'm thinking to myself, you know, I don't want to drink. I don't want to drink. I'm fine. I don't want to drink. I'm not thinking about drinking, you know. But I'm spending all my time thinking about what the hell is wrong with me, you know. And I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was only going to help me with this not drinking thing. That's what I thought. Once I realized that I was like you, I thought all you had to offer me was not drinking. And at 8, 9 months sober, I had not drank for 8 or 9 months. Shouldn't it be better? And it wasn't. And I was slowly dying, and this friend Billy that lives in California, he's just been a savior in my life so many times. He called me, and he said, there's a conference in Washington, D.C. called Singleness of Purpose. There's a guy by the name of Clancy and a guy by the name of Johnny speaking. He said, I'm 15 minutes from your house to pick you up. Be ready. And he hung up on me. He didn't give me a chance to say, no, I don't want to go, or I'm not doing that, or anything. And 15 minutes later, he was banging on my door. And I went to this conference, and I met the home group that I have today. And I was frightened, and I was, you know, didn't know anybody, and I didn't know about this AA thing, and they were all happy, which if you're in untreated alcoholism, is just miserable. You know, I'm so excited you're happy, you know. And there happened to be a guy there who didn't drive, and I had a car. And I became, just like when I was new, I became a personal chauffeur. I eventually moved into a sober house with a bunch of young other sober guys, and I learned how to live in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor again, something I didn't have since I left Blacksburg. And I got a sponsor, and we started to go through the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And by this point, I knew what happened to me if I didn't do something different, both drunk and sober. And I had a willingness I'd never had before. And at 18 months sober, I'd been through the first 9 steps and made a lot of my amends, and the single most important thing that's happened to me in my life to date happened. And that is I started sponsoring another person in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there is not a bigger change in my life. Because for the first time in my life, I actually developed a care for another human being. I could never do that for my parents, although I love them. But when it always came down to it, I always chose me. And here was this guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, just like me. Couldn't stay sober, crazy in the head, you know, everything. And he had asked me for help. And I developed a care for this kid. And I'll tell you something else I developed that has saved my life more than once. I developed convictions in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I can't transmit something I don't have. So I had to get busy finding out what it was I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous so I could help this kid. And shortly thereafter, some of the other guys that I still sponsor today came along. You know, and we began a journey. And it's been an amazing journey over the years. And sponsorship is by far where I think I have grown the most. Because these guys will tick you off. They'll not follow your direction. They'll call you at 2 in the morning, you know. And for a self-centered, self-seeking guy like me, there's not something better in the world. You know, I sponsor a guy today. I wasn't sponsoring him then. He was sober about a year, and he called me at 2 o'clock in the morning. He said, I'm going to commit suicide. And I know that drill, you know. And I said, well, why don't you come over to my house? So he drove over to my house, and he's driving away to my house. I was like, what the hell am I going to do with him now? You know? And I did the only thing that I know to do. And I got to open the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went through the first 9 steps of the program. Well, first 8, because he had to later go out and do 9. First 8 steps of the program till about 4:30 in the morning. He wrote an inventory while I sat there and drank coffee. He read it to me. And he's still sober today. I sponsor him now. And he's doing great. He just picked up somebody that he sponsors. And that's been the deal for me. That's really been Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And the funniest thing is that deal led me back to God. You know, because I struggled with God for years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I still had a lot of the old things, you know. And I love what it says on page 55 of the big book. Deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. But it may be obscured by calamity, pomp, and worship of other things. And if there's anything that describes me better than that in my life, I don't know what it is. Because I've always had calamity because I'm selfish, self-centered. And certainly before I got sober, my whole life was a calamity. You know, pomp. You know, I don't know of any alcoholic that I've ever met that will say that you're more arrogant or you know more or anything than me. I knew so much when I got here, they've had to unteach me everything. And I just, you know, I still believe today. It's just how I'm built, you know. And sometimes my pride and that pomp comes out and I'm better than everybody. And sometimes it's reversed and I'm the lowest thing on earth. But it's the exact same pomp. And so I had the calamity and the pomp and the worship of other things. Just get sober a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll fall in love with a new car, a new house, you know, a better situation. Because all of that's happened to me. I got married when I was really new against the advice of most people. And I've gotten divorced sober because they were right. And they knew something and could see something that I can't. And that is what makes Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship, and everything so vital in my existence, as you all can see things I can't. Because I've still got the same thinking, the same self-centeredness that I've always had. And I'm always going to rationalize what I want. It may take some time, and certainly as I've gotten sober, I've gotten better at rationalizing it, believe it or not. Because now I have to convince the sponsor that what I want is the right thing. But I depend on these people. I depend on them to love me enough to tell me the truth whether I want to hear it or not. And I've fortunately been surrounded by people in my sobriety that have done just that. And I know that that's what I want to do for the people I sponsor. Sometimes I know I'm about to hurt their feelings or upset them or make them angry. But I'd rather they stay sober didn't think that I'm their best friend. And you know, that's not an easy deal to get to, but it's the facts. And I was into the worshiping of other things, and all of that continues to be what keeps me from God, and that keeps me from you. And the spiritual way of life that I'm living today, it is, you know, it's unbelievable to a guy like me. You know, I've had the same routine in the morning for so long, I can't remember how long I've been doing it. I get up every morning, I read a couple of things out of AA literature. I sit for a few minutes in quiet so that I don't just race off into this day of what I'm going to get for me. And then at night, I sit again for a few minutes to calm down, to do that review it talks about in the book. Where was I selfish, dishonest, afraid, and resentful during the day? And then I read something else in Alcoholics Anonymous or another spiritual book, and I go to bed. And I've been surrounded by people that nourish me in that way. You know, after that divorce, which was the lowest time that I know in my sobriety, I didn't think, you know, I thought Alcoholics Anonymous could keep me sober, but I didn't know if it could heal those wounds. And it did, in spades. I met another young lady. We're going to be married in September. And the difference in that relationship and that relationship when I was new are so different that it's hard to even describe to you. This woman is an Alcoholics Anonymous. We get on our knees together every night and pray. Her sponsor and her sponsees and her AA life comes before anything with me, and vice versa. And we bring God into everything we do. And we want other people included in our decision making. You know? Because we know that just as I can't make the best decisions for me, she and I can't make the best decisions for us. Because we can't get outside of our self-centeredness. And as a unit, we live in that same self-centered thinking and thing just as a unit, maybe not individually. And so we've invited, you know, other people, our sponsors, other married people in Alcoholics Anonymous to be a part of our life together. And it's wonderful. And not every day that I've been sober has been a great day. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no hope. And I truly believed at 23 years old that taking 32 sleeping pills was the best option left. And it doesn't matter what's happened to me sober. I've lost jobs, I've lost houses, I've lost cars, been married and divorced. It doesn't matter about any of that stuff. I've never lost hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I come to a meeting and I see you all and I hear somebody that's been there and stayed sober through it. So I know that nothing's going to come down the pike, that somebody isn't gone before me, that they're not going to know the pitfalls that lie ahead, the ways that I can steer clear of what's going on. And you know, all the problems, if I have problems, all the problems I had today are in areas that did not exist before I was sober. You know, because I live a life beyond my own capabilities. You know, that family that was so torn apart, I talk to my mother and my father twice a week, you know, and they still live in Blacksburg during the fall. I see them a lot because I'll go home for Tech football games, and we have a great relationship. And the brother that was sick growing up that has a lot of problems that I do not understand, he and I can have a conversation, and he can be around the guys I sponsor and the people in AA and be comfortable. I've even taken him to AA meetings because he relates to sickness. But I have a relationship with him today. And not all those relationships are where I want them to be. But I believe that they're where God wants them to be right now. And I believe that that's the truth for me in all my sobriety. I may not be where I want to be, but I'm certainly where God wants me to be. And if I can focus on the I'm where God wants me to be, then I can have that happy, joyous, and free that is the whole point of this deal. I can have a happy, sober life. I can put my focus on somebody else because I'm going to be taken care of by that third step person that I've asked to relieve me of the bondage of self. So the results of my life are up to him. And my job on a daily basis is to try and give back to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the people at my work, to the people I run in on the street. And every day is not a perfect day with that. I still get angry. Traffic can drive me crazy. People at work can yell at me and frustrate me. But I'm not creating damage today like I created back then. And if I make a mistake today, I got the wonderful thing that it talks about in the 10th step, promptly admitting when I'm wrong. You only get one chance at promptly, a friend of mine says. And I don't know how close I get to that. But I'm able to go back and right the wrongs today. And I'm not afraid to see anybody on the streets anymore. I don't have to look down at my shoes every time I walk into a room. And there's no place that I feel like I'm not welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the most important thing to me. In my home group, in the places I go, I want any drunk that walks in the room to feel welcome. And I love going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like yours, where everybody's introducing themselves and people are talking before the meeting, and it's obvious that you guys have a care for one another. Because that's what I found in that meeting in Blacksburg that helped me come back that second night. And that's what I believe is the foundation of what has kept me sober all these years. It's one drunk talking to another, but it's not about me. It's about us. I'm blessed beyond belief. I can't even imagine what's to come. But a friend of mine, he said to me at the lowest point in my sobriety, he said, "If you stay sober, the best is yet to come." And I believe him. I just can't imagine what that's going to be. But I know that it's going to be great. You know, I know that it's going to be filled with Alcoholics Anonymous if I continue to come here. And I know as long as I continue to come here, there's always going to be opportunities to enrich my life. And I've never been a person that wanted status quo. Never. And Alcoholics Anonymous is anything but status quo. And I appreciate you guys listening and having me out here. Thanks.